Good evening, everyone, and thank you very much to all of you for attending tonight's panel discussion. My name is Peter Wingrove. I am the CEO of ShoreMind, a young charity on a mental health mission. Our mission is to make sure that everyone has access to mental health and well-being resources when they need them. In 2016, our charity raised 103,000 signatures to have children's mental health education debated in Parliament, and the result was ultimately that children's mental health education became compulsory in September this year. But the job is not yet done. We know that teachers are not trained in mental health, not as part of their formal training, and neither are they trained once they become teachers and are actually operating in schools, teaching in schools. And therefore, we as a charity, we feel that we need to build an impetus throughout the country to change that status quo. I'm very pleased to have met David Gumbrell. I beg your pardon. David is an author, coach, and presenter around the theme of resilience. He's written two books for teachers on the subject, and recently one for children too. David works part-time at Kingston University on teacher training program, teacher history, and science. He was one of the external advisors for mental health for the ITT framework, and he convened this panel for us this evening. I'm very pleased also to introduce Professor Sam Twistleton, OBE. She's the director of Sheffield Institute of Education and also vice president external of the Chartered College of Teaching. She was the chair of the initial teacher training core content framework committee, who defined the minimum entitlement of all trainee teachers. Also tonight, we're joined by Adrian Bethune, is a part-time teacher and author of Wellbeing in the Primary Classroom, A Practical Guide to Teaching Happiness, and co-author of A Little Guide to Teacher Wellbeing and Self-Care. Adrian is also the lead curriculum designer for Oxford University Press and education policy co-lead at the Mindfulness Initiative. Adrian was one of the external advisors for mental health for the ITT framework. And last but not least, we've got Catherine Carden. She is Faculty Director of Teaching and Learning at Canterbury Christ Church University. She was awarded a fellowship of the Chartered College of Teaching in 2019. She's the author of Primary Teaching, Learning and Teaching in Primary Schools Today, and co-founder of Barden Education. Catherine was one of the external advisors for mental health for the ITT framework. Good evening, everyone. And thank you for being prepared to give up your time. I know it's a busy time for all of you. I'd like to start off by asking, why is teacher well-being important, and why is it important for us to focus on this now? If we could perhaps ask you, Professor Twistleton.
Oh no, I was hoping you could ask one of these more expert people than me. I mean, I'm going to give you a sort of fairly simple, basic answer that without well teachers, you can't have well teaching, which means that you can't put pupils first. So it's very tempting when you're talking about teachers, schools and teachers and pupils, to start with, we put pupils first. And that's what many really good teachers and heads will tell you when you speak to them. But actually, if you want to put pupils first, you've actually got to put your teachers first as well, because they can't put their pupils first if they're not well, if they're not well mentally and physically. And so without well teachers who feel comfortable and at ease with themselves, you can't have effective teaching, which means that you can't have effective putting of pupils first. So that's my very simplistic, but I think hopefully truthful answer.
Catherine, how about you? How do you see it?
Well, I completely agree with Sam in that we do talk often about it's all about the pupils, it's all about the pupils, but teaching is a job that takes a huge toll on someone's physical and mental health. Actually, we're isolated in a way, and that's a strange thing to say when you're surrounded by people and children all day, but actually as a teacher in a classroom, it's quite isolating. You're making decisions on your own all the time. So in terms, it's really intense in that way. And we work long hours as teachers, or teachers work extraordinarily long hours. And that might go counter to what you read in some elements of the media, on social media and so on. But the hours that teachers put in to deliver and meet the whole range of things that they're required to do is huge. So actually to maintain throughout the term, good mental and physical health is absolutely vital to enable teachers to just fulfill their basic function.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Adrian? How do you see it?
Yeah, I'd echo what Catherine and Sam have said. You know, I also come at it from a perspective of teachers modelling good well-being to students. We know that, you know, young people, children, you know, pick up examples from significant caregivers. There's a quote from developmental psychologist Alison Gopnik that I love, which says, children learn far more from their caregivers' unconscious behaviours than any of their conscious manipulations. So we need to understand that as teachers, we have, yes, a responsibility to teach kind of formal curriculum, but also a responsibility to model what it is to look after oneself. So the example we set directly impacts and indirectly impacts children and what they're likely to kind of learn and kind of copy from our example. As Sam said, and Catherine, teacher effectiveness, we know from a vast array of research, just generally in the workplace, that employees, happier, healthier employees tend to do their jobs better. They're more flexible in their thinking, they're more resilient, they have less time off sick. You know, they're more productive, and teachers are no different. You know, when we feel kind of healthy and happy, we tend to just do our jobs better. And even when things are difficult in the classroom, we tend to handle those difficult situations more effectively. And then finally, you know, to take our responsibilities, just put them to one side, like it's just like ultimately the meaning of life, which is to carve out a life that is enjoyable and important and meaningful. And so our well-being, regardless of anyone else and how it impacts on anyone else, is just something that we all are striving for, to leave a life that we are happy and content with.
David, how do you feel?
Yeah, I agree with all that's been said before. I think we're a compassionate profession, aren't we? Compassionate to everyone other than ourselves. And we don't put the self in front of compassion. So we do what Sam's saying, and we put the children first, but we actually need to put ourselves first, and we need to put self-compassion in. So we can cut ourselves a nice life, but we can also be the happy teacher that children deserve. And I think that we're in danger of tiring ourselves out and putting ourselves under an unsustainable system, a routine or a timetable. So we're exhausted. We're the exhausted teacher in front of those children, but they deserve better than that. They deserve a happy teacher. They deserve an engaging teacher. And we can't do that unless we top ourselves up and not feel guilty by that. But I also think we've got to stop ourselves from being the smorgasbord attention at all times. We can be WhatsApped or contacted on our phones or contacted on our emails. And we need to just protect our time at home and define that home and school a little bit more sharply, so that we can have that rest and recovery time. It's just so important if we want to be that teacher that we want to be.
Kind of building on what David just said, one of the problems with being a teacher, and it's not only for teachers, it's lots of jobs, but I think it's particularly prominent for teachers, is that you never metaphorically clear your desk. There's always more you could be doing. And, you know, the WhatsApps and the emails are one example. But there's always more you could be doing. You could be preparing more. You could be marking more. You could be thinking more about, you know, the individual child that's given you little cause for concern that day. There's always more that you could be doing. And so there's a real danger. And we really see this with trainees and early career teachers, that, you know, they'll work all the evenings and all the weekends sort of doing all that more. And they'll still never clear the desk because there's always even more. And actually what happens then is everything that everybody's said, they're exhausted. They haven't had the kind of opportunity to kind of find themselves and have their own kind of mental health looked after. And actually in the end, that's not good for the children. So even though they may have worked all those hours, for absolutely the right reasons, in the end, is actually not contributing to making the best deal for those children, which is a hard message to get across sometimes to new teachers.
Absolutely.
And just, sorry, can I build on that?
Go ahead, Catherine.
Actually, we just see a spiral then. Then it leads into this spiral of decline, in that you've got a tired teacher, then becoming less affected, they're more snappy in the classroom. The behaviour of the children in that classroom declines as well, and they're trying then to cope with that and doing everything else, and it kind of spirals into this thoughts of I can't do it, and then creeps in other mental health and anxiety issues around their capability of doing the job in their own mind. And actually, if they could rewind and manage much earlier on, they'd never get to that point. And then, of course, we know from research and leaving teachers that leave the profession, stress and anxiety is a key reason why they're leaving. And maybe if we could have addressed it much earlier, they would never have got to that point, and they could be a very happy and fulfilled teacher.
I agree.
Sorry, Adrian, just I want to speak about that, about teachers leaving the profession, which, you know, in a previous panel discussion, we heard some statistics of teachers leaving the teaching profession within the first 5 years. Now, how long does it take a teacher to train?
Depends which route they take.
Yeah, Catherine? Yeah.
It depends which route they take. So teachers can either do a degree followed by a PGCE or a school direct program as a graduate,
right,
or there are still undergraduate 3-year QTS programs. So, you know, well, I would say it's 3 to 4 years, because you can't just do a PGCE. So for people to say it takes 1 year to train, actually they've done a degree beforehand. So, yeah. It depends which route you take, but sometimes they're leaving.
There is a problem. There is a problem for those who take the postgraduate route. I mean, Catherine's right. You can't just ignore the fact that they've already done a degree. But in terms of learning the craft of teaching, for those people, whether it's PGCE or without a PGCE, QTS only, it's effectively 9 months. Which is far too short a time to really learn all the complex things that you need to know and be able to do as a teacher. And that's why the early career framework was brought in to effectively extend that length of time and support and development. And so from next year, that will be there for everybody, and will effectively give everybody a minimum of 3 years. I mean, longer if you've taken one of the routes that Catherine talked about, which, I mean, you know, high performing systems elsewhere in the world usually take at least 3, often 5. And then and then often there's a lot of support and development ongoing after that as well. And I think we're moving in that direction in England, but it's you know, it would have been good if it had been sooner than this.
Yeah, and
sorry, Catherine, go ahead.
I was just going to say, to add to what Sam says, we need, I think, for the PGCE 1 year versions or QTS only, there is such a little amount of thinking time, because everything. So if you take a 3 year route, basically you're squashing it into 9 months, crudely speaking. And they're doing the same number of days in their placement school. They've got the same content to cover. So their thinking time is far reduced. And if you take a 3-year undergraduate route, not saying that that's better or worse, but actually what it does allow is that the placement days are spread over 3 years. There is more space for them to think and do other things as well. So I think thinking time as well is key in PGCE, or the lack of thinking time.
Okay, I think the challenge with any kind of organization, and you know, let's remember for a minute that the school is an organization that employs people, and I know teachers get into teaching really because they've got a passion and a love for teaching, a love for children. But it's also an organization, and having spoken to a number of head teachers, they seem genuinely concerned about how do they approach the issue of well-being when the schedule is, you know, the schedule of work is already so much. So, you know, I suppose my question then is, how does the ITT frameworks approach, or how does the ITT framework set out an approach to time and task management? to provide support for teachers who are struggling with their well-being?
Do you want me to kick off on that?
Go ahead.
I think it's important to understand what the framework is and also what it isn't. And what it certainly isn't is a full answer to your question, because it's what it isn't is a full answer to anybody who's trying to devise a comprehensive, really effective initial teacher training curriculum. It's not a curriculum, it's a framework. It's a really good thing, in my view. Obviously, I would say that. I wouldn't have agreed to chair the advisory group if I didn't think it was a good idea. And the point of it is to latch into the early career framework. So where we just kind of left the conversation previously was, you know, how short ITT is. And as part of the recruitment and retention strategy that the DfE brought in a couple of years ago, they recognised they needed to do something about that. And their first response was to develop the early career framework, which is this two-year programme of support for newly qualified teachers and recently qualified teachers for the first 2 years. And again, that's a framework. So between them, the two work together to create this, what hopefully a coherent framework of experiences and entitlements, actually. I think the entitlement aspect is quite important for early career teachers. But what good ITT providers and good schools who support ITT providers and support early career teachers need to do is build a whole rich set of experiences and support around that framework. What the framework does do is give quite a lot of specific advice, particularly for those who are supporting trainees in school on placement. There's a lot for mentors to look at and think about, but also a whole range of other expert colleagues who good trainees need to have access to. So, you know, it might be the Senko, it might be the pastoral lead, it might be the person who is the teaching assistant who works with this particular individual child who has a particular set of conditions it's really helpful trainees to learn more about. And gives a whole series of prompts for the kinds of observations, the kinds of discussions, the kinds of activities that would be really helpful for that trainee to have wrapped around them. So it becomes almost like an entitlement. It's described in the document as an entitlement for trainees in terms of the range of different kinds of support and experiences they should have. But good ITT providers will do so much more than that and do so much more than that. So if you look at what's in there, in terms of specific reference to mental health, both of teachers and of pupils, it's there, but it's in a fairly minimal, basic kind of way. Because what we know is that really good ITT providers like Canterbury Christchurch, where Catherine works, when I visited there for the Carter Review, I was absolutely blown away by all the range of things that they do that wouldn't be described by that minimum basic entitlement that's in the framework. So I haven't really answered your question.
No, but Sam, on that point, I mean, do you think it's sufficient? Do you think that, I mean, we had this discussion just before we went live about the fact that it's a framework. It's not the entire body of work. It's the framework, and implementation partners need to read between the lines, so to speak, and use their own initiative to expand, particularly the well-being section. Can you maybe ask Catherine how? Yeah. Please, please, not just well-being, of course. Yeah. Catherine, how do you do it at Canterbury Christchurch? How do you deal with well-being specifically?
Well, I think the key element to me is that well-being shouldn't be seen as a tag on kind of, we had the session on well-being. Do you remember coming to that? As I think that should be the case with many things, you know, you did the session on behaviour, you know, we need to thread it through. And I think we need to thread it through everything we teach to student teachers. It needs to appear when we're talking about assessment. And we need to have critical conversations. And I think that's the key, to have critical conversations about, you know, if we're talking about marking, what is it about marking and challenging? Why are some teachers writing paragraphs in reception children's books when they can't read? It sounds stupid, but it is. So why are we wasting our time? We need to unpick so that actually what we're equipping our student teachers as they go out into their classrooms as qualified teachers is the toolkit of critical questioning about what they're doing, not if this happens, do this, because we'll never be able to cover every possible scenario. And yeah, it's getting them to reflect upon their practice, asking where they need to spend the time, and talking to them about that. So having what a significant dialogue in a whole manner of different ways. But also, I think it's up to us as their tutors, who have all been there and done it ourselves, to model exactly this. So where I work, and I used to lead primary initial teacher education before I did my current job, we moved to a place where we were not expecting staff to work on emails outside of working hours and at weekends. Now, you can do if you want, we weren't saying you can't, but I think it's really important that we model to our students that you don't need to, it's good to take a break. Is if they haven't cracked it, how can I when I'm in my first year? So I think we need to model it, we need to talk about it, but also really be careful that we don't say around time management that you should leave school at five, because that doesn't work for everyone. And it's about enabling teachers and student teachers to really come together and think about what works for them. So if you've got a young family, some people leave school early and then start work again in the evening. Other people, it works that they work all day on a Sunday for them, but they don't work so much in the week. So it's about people getting their own ebb and flow right, not giving do this, leave school at five, don't be there at six, you know, all these kind of stories you hear. Some people like getting kicked out by the caretaker because it works for them. And I talk a lot as well about, I hate the term work-life balance, so I challenge that a lot when we have these conversations, that you can't achieve a work-life balance, and actually every time you fail, you're increasing your own anxiety and stress by failing more. So I talk a lot to students about a managed disequilibrium around work, well-being really, rather than a work-life balance, because actually teaching, you can't look at your work and your life separately because they're so intertwined, as most jobs are, to be honest, and you certainly can't get a balance, but they need to manage the disequilibrium of their lives well and get to grips. So that was a long answer to your question of explicitly and implicitly kind of we model it, but we certainly avoid telling them what to do and how to manage their workload, because in a group of 200 students, they're going to have 200 different ways of doing it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I guess what I'm taking from that is, rather than dealing with well-being or with mental health as a compartmentalized item, you're looking at holistically, you're looking at it holistically in terms of the entire work and personal life of the individual, but not so restrictively as to define it, you must be doing this, you know, X, Y, and Z. To say, here are some guidelines, here are some pointers, and these are the things that you should be considering or looking at. And then also looking at the actual work content, right? If I understood you correctly, what you were saying was, what is the reporting requirement of teachers, for example? And is it fit for purpose? Is that perhaps not contributing to the breakdown in their well-being, amongst other things? And I'm sure there's, you know, in any profession, there's hundreds of these examples. So if we understand it correctly, then the ITT framework is literally just the skeleton. It's the framework to provide a guideline. Catherine, at your organization, for instance, you take it a step further by saying, okay, well, listen, let's interpret that in as broad a context as possible and provide some specific guidelines and examples for trainee teachers. But let's then also look at how they're going to be conducting their work. And is their work not perhaps contributing to, well, you know, potentially to well-being issues? And if so, how can we look at mitigating that?
Yeah.
Adrian, tell us about your experience, perhaps as a teacher. How do you interpret the ITT framework? And do you feel that it gives you that kind of guidance as a teacher to be able to adapt to your well-being?
I guess I come at well-being from a slightly different perspective. in as much as I'm really fascinated by what I and other people call the science of well-being, which is a kind of, you know, a scientific psychological study of, broadly speaking, what works for improving individual well-being, for improving workplace well-being. And when I talk about the kind of scientific study, like an organization that I have a huge amount of respect for is called the What Works Center for Wellbeing. It's a UK-based organization. And they use essentially the same kind of clinical standards that NICE, you know, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, use in terms of the NHS and kind of medical interventions. So they look at interventions that or things that affect, you know, people's well-being, and they try and kind of inform policy decisions based on that. And so what I've done from my personal experience of being a teacher is look at the science of well-being and try and experiment with ideas like that might benefit me. And as Catherine said, you know, what affects our well-being can be very subjective. So, you know, to take part in, to do a mindfulness course, which has really benefited me, if someone else is to do it, they might not get the same or any benefit from it. So what I would like to see on kind of ITT courses is, you know, teaching has, there's been a lot of noise about us becoming an evidence-informed profession, because before there has been some real unevidenced initiatives, kind of drives, fads that have come in and then gone because there's no science or study behind them. It's just become very popular. So what I would like to see on ITT is a sharing of the research, the evidence of what can work to improve your well-being on an individual level and then on a kind of workplace school level. And then for, you know, trainee teachers to be encouraged to experiment with that. You know, when I was training to be a teacher at London South Bank University, I had to carry out a kind of science experiment as one of my projects to get credits to pass my course. And thankfully, the tutor allowed it to be quite a broad scientific kind of project. And what I did it on was my question to investigate was, can a mindfulness course reduce teachers' stress levels? And I had to, you know, find kind of psychological stress tests to do and make it kind of quite scientific. But actually that was like, I was given permission to experiment with something. I was creative and chose to do it on a teacher wellbeing topic using kind of scientific methods. And I would like to see that kind of more, but on a mental health wellbeing perspective, like encouraging students to learn about the science of wellbeing or what impacts wellbeing, try stuff out with their students, but also for them as teachers, and just work out what works for them. Because yeah, it's been a series, and it continues to be a series of kind of experiments for me. Even like moving school, you know, things that worked in my previous school don't work in a different context. So you've got to be adaptable and flexible. So yeah, that's what I would like to see more of on ITT.
David, let's you know, go to you for a second on following on what's been said so far. How would you advise teachers and school heads to be able to encourage their teachers to access resources, to, as Adrian was saying, experiment with different aspects and with the science of well-being?
Yeah, I think... Firstly, I just want to say that I think that the ITT framework does something really well, which is that they emphasize the role of the mentor. And actually, if we're happy at school and we feel safe at school, as in professionally safe, because we feel as if we're being guided well, then we're going to be in a much better place. And so what the ITT framework does fantastically well is keep emphasizing the importance of mentorship. And I was listening to the wonderful Professor Rachel Lofthouse last night, actually, about an education webinar, and just saying, and she was talking about how influential a mentor can be on an early career teacher, and that significant changes in terms of developing ideas and reciprocal in terms of learning and new practices emerge, but also the kind of guidance and role model that we so need for these young teachers to guide them and support them. I absolutely agree also that Adrian is right in terms of having some more research-based informative practice. But that informed practice, I think, or research practice, needs to be guided by the teacher's own interest. And what I fear is that we go into a research program that's driven by quantitative data outcomes, and therefore potentially might not be of motivation for the individual, but may be motivated by external sources or from for the school's purposes. So firstly, ITT program, I think, does really well on the mentoring. I'd like to hear other people's thoughts on that. But secondly, going back to Adrian's idea of a research project, but for the, driven by them, a little bit of autonomy on that. And I fear that it might not be that. What do you think, Adrian?
Yeah, well, from my experience, that science project where I chose mindfulness, that was definitely my autonomous decision, because I was experiencing kind of quite acute levels of stress. I'd retrained from being working in music publishing to then doing the graduate teacher program and literally in the deep end. So yeah, it was something, mindfulness was something I had read about and was interested in. And so this project gave me permission to then explore that as a trainee teacher, and it really benefited me. And then I actually started to weave it into my teaching practice as well, and start to kind of teach mindfulness techniques to my year five class at the time. But just on the point of mentorship, David, because I think that's a massively important point. When I reflect on my kind of teacher training journey as a graduate teacher program trainee, I had a class mentor, my official class mentor. So I was teaching bits of lessons, observing her teach, and then kind of taking parts of lessons myself. And then I had a kind of mentor tutor at university as well, who had come in and observe and mentor me. But what I also found massively beneficial, and I also think we need to encourage this in schools, is that I had, I would say, two or three, if not more, unofficial mentors within the school community. And actually that massively helped me as well, because there were times where I had issues with my mentor. There were things that maybe she was getting me to do that I didn't agree with, or I felt she was pushing me too hard. And I didn't have that relationship at the time to say, look, I'm not happy with this. But because I had other people to speak to in the school, and other people that kind of took me under their wing, that massively helped as well. And so what, you know, I've never been an official mentor in school, but I've definitely been unofficially people's mentors, trainee teachers, because from my own experience, I've understood how important it is to have other experienced teachers in the school look out for you as well as your official mentor. So I think we need to encourage these cultures of mentorship in schools. And
that's exactly what I was talking about earlier, Adrian. That's exactly what's being picked up in the framework. I'm glad that, David, that you sort of picked that up as well. So it's not just about the mentor. Mm. It's about all the other people in the school, and not just in the school, outside of the school as well, who need to kind of wrap themselves around the trainee. But the trainee also needs to be proactive and have agency themselves in seeking out that support. Can I just pick up on the thing about on research? I think your example, Adrian, is a really good example, but very illustrative of what we saw a lot of when on the Carter Review of Initial Teacher Training. Many providers will take that kind of open approach, which means that you can follow your own interests, but within, you know, within a framework. And I think, you know, I wouldn't want a message to be going out that ITT providers don't do this, because I think many of them do that really well. And that's one of the reasons why the framework is a framework, because we didn't want to stifle the really good practice that was already in there. Another really important aspect, though, of looking at evidence and collecting your own evidence is comparing it and contrasting it across a range of different contexts. And that's one of the things, I'm worried about this year, actually, with COVID and the potential impact on trainees' placement experiences, is if they end up only having experience in one school, which is one possibility, that will be a really missed opportunity, because comparing and contrasting different approaches in different schools, including different forms of mentoring, but also there might be a different approach to the curriculum, might be a different approach to workload and marking, and there'll certainly be a different kind of culture. There'll be different things that trainees will pick up on. It will help them not only doing that kind of critiquing of, you know, what works and what doesn't work in my view, and what's the evidence base these different approaches, but it will also help them work out what kind of school they want to work in as an NQT. And that's one of the things that the DfE found when they did some research into teacher recruitment and retention. The most interesting group of people that they spoke to were the ones who thought about dropping out of the profession fairly early on and then hadn't. Talking about what had stopped them, and nearly always it was changing school, and realizing that what felt like, oh, it always has to be like this in this school because it's the only school I've ever really taught in. The school down the road might take a completely different approach and might work for that person much better. Just as Catherine said, you know, one size will not fit all. So I think that, you know, a good mentoring, good research, good looking at evidence, really important, but also being able to contrast different approaches.
And so, I mean, a couple of things that stick out to me from that is that from what's been said, David, Adrian, and Sam, is there's a lot of onus placed on the newly qualified teacher to develop these skills, to develop the, shall I say, constructs with which to test different ideas, different, you know, practices and that. And I just think that there's already a lot of pressure, psychological pressure. I'm just thinking as a new employee, for example, there's a lot of psychological pressure on one just to perform, just to do things right. To additionally now have to take on this burden of testing. Now, Adrian, you indicated it was very helpful to you in your case, for instance, to have other teachers take you under their wing, you know, show you the ropes, so to speak. But one can't always guarantee that all schools are like that. You know, every working environment, as we know, every organization is different. Every working environment, working culture is different. Is there any way in which the framework provides for head teachers, school governors, to put in place a basic well-being program that will allow young teachers this kind of experience or exposure to these constructs?
I wouldn't necessarily describe it as you open the document and you find, yes, here are the instructions for me as a head teacher as to how to put in a wellbeing program for my trainees. I don't think they would open it and find that. What I think they will find is a lot more specific advice for the kinds of conversations, the kinds of activities, the kinds of observations that are going to be really helpful for those trainees. It's the kinds of things that good schools would do anyway, but it lays it out with a bit more specific guidance than previous attempts have done. So it's not putting all the onus on the trainees. I think there's quite a lot in there that the trainees are entitled to and they can use as an entitlement if they want to. Having said that, I think it is really important that in the formation of teacher identity, right from the beginning, that sense of agency and that sense of, yes, you have got to be proactive. You have got to make some of these things happen for yourself. That's what makes us professionals. So you have to have the support to do that, absolutely. But some of it does have to come from the individual as well. And I think what we try to do is get a balance of that support and that entitlement, along with a sense of agency, of being proactive and of doing that kind of critical comparison piece yourself, because that is what makes us professionals. And, you know, effective teachers need to be professionals.
Adrian, how does your course reflect that, instilling that level of agency in young teachers? How do you bring that across?
So firstly, I think really, like I said before, it's about engaging in critical and robust conversations early on and enabling teachers to understand their place in the profession. And we do teach, and most ITT providers do this, we do discuss professional teacher as a professional, being what does it mean to be a professional, and being quite critical about asking, are we actually a profession as teachers, because of certain, you know, historic elements that we haven't really had a professional body until the Chartered College came about. We had a kind of place where we had nobody, and we do, it's about thinking of ourselves as a professional and creating that autonomy and then the agency. So it's all very well to think about autonomy, but then agency is about doing it, applying it, and making it real. And in it's so complex that it's the ITT core content enables a starting point for a conversation, really, with mentors and with student teachers. This is your minimum entitlement. This is what you need to provide in the setting for students. But it's so complex because it's about then the conversations that are had between the ITT provider and the mentor, and through mentor training and so on for them, about how they're interacting and allowing their student to experiment, because some will and some won't. You know, some say this is how I do it and that's how you're going to do it, and that's not really a teacher education. So it's about how providers work with their mentors and the mentor training. It's how they work with their students, and sometimes there are really difficult and robust conversations to be had between both. Then you've got the school culture and moving forward, and how head teachers are interpreting all sorts of things, not the ITT core content, because I'll be quite honest, I don't think teachers probably have engaged with it at all, and they don't, but they're looking at the Ofsted framework, they're looking at their league tables, all the varying pressure that head teachers are under, and therefore their school culture's created. So you've got that layer as well, that you've got students going into settings that are completely different with regards to their cultures. And some are very much about do it like this, we use schemes, follow the script. Others are about experiment, we'll be there to support you. There's no right, I'm not advocating a right or wrong way and saying that, you know, you shouldn't use schemes or whatever, but the cultures are just so different. So it's so complex and layered that actually, and then you've got the layer of governance who should be challenging the head teacher about how they're managing staff wellbeing and culture within their school. And to get it all right is quite hard. And I actually think it takes courage on everyone's part. It takes courage for the student teacher to experiment. It takes courage to have those difficult conversations. It takes courage for the head teacher to prioritize well-being over certain other pressures. So in an environment perhaps where there's at times more fear than anything else. So it's really complex, and I don't think there's a kind of here's the recipe.
So firstly, you create the sense of profession, an understanding of what it means to be a professional, create that agency within the individual, and then encourage them to go and look. But obviously then constrained within the strictures of the school environment. David, how do you advise school heads to approach this? Because obviously a young teacher coming into the profession today is has a different mindset, I suppose, to someone who might have entered the profession 20 or 30 years ago.
Well, firstly, I think that the climate is challenging at the moment, but also pre-COVID, it was also challenging to find the time to build relationships. And I go into lots of staff rooms where, well, they used to be like Clapham Junction, everyone kind of passes through them and doesn't stay for very long. So those connections and those relationships are breaking down a little bit more because we're not spending that time with colleagues and really supporting. And I love the idea of an unofficial mentor. And I can see Adrian being a very good unofficial mentor in his school. And I'm sure there are many people that are going, yeah, I want to be an unofficial mentor. It's kind of like a title.
They want Adrian to be their unofficial mentor.
But it's like a lovely title that could matter, because then you're not judge and jury. And I think there's a danger, isn't there, of kind of pseudo mentor, because you're trying to be one and not the other, or the other and not the other. But I think it's also protecting time. So I hear a lot of NQTs that don't get their time. So I'm really heartened by the idea that the NQT is going to continue to get some time, but we've got to protect that time. And the student's got to be brave, or the NQT's got to be brave and protect that time and get that mentor support. But the classic one is, are you okay? And the classic answer is, I'm fine. And there's no other answer than I'm fine or cry, because they are the only two socially acceptable options at the moment. But what we've got to get to is, no, I do actually want some time. I do want some professional dialogue. I do want support. I do want to hear from my unofficial mentor or my official mentor to guide me in what I need to guide me in the next step of my journey. But I think that for me as a head teacher, we've got to minimize the paperwork and prioritize the people. And we've got to connect with the people before we try and correct the things that they are doing. So it's about connecting first and then correcting, or in inverted commas, because we shouldn't be correcting, but just kind of challenging after that. And that's what I tried to do as a head teacher. It was never easy to achieve that, but that's what I tried to do. What do you do in your school, Adrian?
Well, do you know, I'd just like to pick up on a couple of points. So, Peter, you kind of mentioned kind of new trainees and whether they have maybe different perceptions of or expectations with work. And actually, in my last school, someone that I was an unofficial mentor to, I personally felt like she had unrealistic expectations about how she could manage everything. And in her mind, she literally wanted to kind of finish schoolwork at 4, leave everything at school, just go home, have the whole evening to herself, and then come in. And, you know, I was kind of conflicted because on the one hand, that's kind of what I have worked to try and achieve, but it's taken me a long time. And that's partly because in order to get to that stage, you need a lot of experience, I think, to know as a teacher, what is the most efficient way of doing this one task. And yeah, you can talk about verbal feedback and you can make this part of teacher training, but so much of teacher training is learning through doing the job and in a way learning the hard way. And so I kind of felt, and I was trying to kind of suggest this to her, she's making her life harder by doing less, if that makes sense. Early on in my career, when I was like, right, that's it, I'm not going to do anything else this weekend, you get to Monday morning and you're like, like you haven't prepared anything, and actually you're more stressed and it's far more challenging feeling unprepared. So there is a balance to be struck between doing more and then feeling when you're stepping into school that day, okay, I'm ready for this. But other people would argue, and I probably agree with them, you know, teachers during the week should have less contact time, so they have more time in the school day without a class in front of them, so they have more preparation planning time. Like the school I currently work in virtually has double PPA allowance. Teachers have about 4 hours a week, and so they have more time to get stuff ready, they have more time to mark, they have more time to just, you know, think about a lesson and maybe mull something over so yeah, the other thing I'd like to talk about, which has come up a lot, which I think is really important, is agency and this personal responsibility for well-being. And the reason I talk about, like, we all have an individual personal responsibility to look after ourselves, and that responsibility, yes, culture massively plays a big part in that, and schools and school leaders have a responsibility to look after their staff, but ultimately my well-being is, because it's so important, I want to be mostly in charge of my well-being. And I had a head teacher contact me about my new book, which is about teacher well-being. And she was like, my staff are fantastic. The parents are so happy with how the kids have come back and transitioned, but they are running themselves into the ground. And I hear from so many head teachers, like, our culture, everything is designed to set teachers up to you know, do less of the paperwork and more of the connecting, but they are still overworking. They're going above and beyond and they really don't need to, and they are burning themselves out. So we do have a personal responsibility to not overwork. And I do think there is a balance to be struck. Whether you call it work-life balance, which Catherine doesn't like, a balance where you're happy. You're happy with the amount of work you're doing. You're happy with the amount of free time and everything else you can do. But I would say it's a continual work in progress, and it will constantly ebb and flow. And you have to, you need experience and kind of wisdom to learn. You know, I've got too much on right now. Okay, next month, is there anything that I can clear the decks a lot? You know, next week or next month is not as intense as this.
I'd like to just make one final observation before I ask our two audience members if they have any questions, Julie and Sammy. I'd like to ask David and Adrian, you specifically speak a lot about the onus is on the individual, which I understand. And of course, the onus is on the individual. But just looking at the organizational context, right, the school as an employer, surely there's a huge responsibility on the senior leadership team to provide mentors, to provide a well-being program, and to actually envisage a structure or a framework in which a culture of well-being can be developed by the individual.
Definitely. Yeah, we shouldn't be setting up trainee teachers, experienced teachers, anybody that works in education, we shouldn't be setting them up to fail. And the onus shouldn't be so much on them that they're working against, you know, the culture in order to look after themselves. So completely, it's basically in the same vein as teachers need to, you know, we need to focus on teacher well-being so that we can then focus on pupils. It's the same as, you know, teachers have an individual responsibility to look after themselves, and the school culture, climate, ethos has a responsibility to create the climate, you know, for teachers to and children to thrive. So they have equal weighting. I guess my point earlier was that even when the culture is right, teachers can still be burning out because they're doing too much, and then they're not recognizing the signs that actually I can't keep going at this level, and then, you know, they kind of fizzle out. And I've been there. I've been there myself.
That most teachers are perfectionists. That's the problem. We want to do it perfectly, and it's not helped by having, I know it doesn't happen now, but we've got the legacy of the outstanding teacher, the good teacher, and so on. We all want to be outstanding. Reality is, we're not outstanding. Most part, we have outstanding moments. All of us are experienced teachers, teacher educators. We've done all right, but we have outstanding moments, but most of the time we're good enough. And I think that's a really important message that I certainly talk to trainee teachers about. Good enough is good enough. You'll have moments of being absolutely outstanding, but to strive to be perfect day in, day out, you will burn yourself out. So it's about giving yourself permission to not be perfect.
Yep. Really. That's a very important point, Catherine. I think in any profession, you set out, and I was reflecting on this a couple of weeks ago. Teachers don't get into teaching because of the money. They get in because of the passion. And I think when you feel that way about something, you really, really want to be outstanding. It absorbs your whole life, doesn't it? We spoke earlier, you said you don't like the work-life balance concept because it doesn't apply to teaching. You're in teaching because you're passionate about it. And I think what you've just highlighted is a very important point. If you're striving for perfection, you're always going to fail because you are your own worst judge. You know what your weaknesses are, and therefore you're always going to be judging yourself according to those weaknesses. And that's, of course, then a vicious circle, and you begin the downward spiral with regards to your mental health.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really important point that you've made. Adrian, coming back to you. Yeah, sorry, Catherine.
I just want to say us as teacher educators and mentors also need to be open with trainees and early career teachers that we're not perfect, because they do look at their tutors at university, their mentors, and they think, oh, you do it and it's so easy. And I think we also need to be honest and say when we're struggling and that we, you know, don't find it easy as well. I think there's a big thing around honesty around how we manage ourselves as well.
Well, that's stigma again, isn't it? And we find that across all organizations in all walks of life. It's very difficult for people to speak about mental health when it's affecting them. And David, you mentioned earlier, there's only two answers. How you feel? How are you doing today? Well, how do you feel today? I'm fine. Or burst into tears. And that's because we have not yet given ourselves the permission. And indeed, we're not communicating to others that we're giving them permission to open up without judgment to us. And I think that's the role that especially the TraumaMind wants to play in the teacher well-being space, is to work to break down that stigma and arm people with the emotional vocabulary to really be able to get to grips with how they're feeling and interpret those feelings and deal with them then accordingly. I'd like to go to Sammy and Julie, our two audience members, and ask either of you, Sammy, if we can begin with you, if you have any questions for our panelists this evening. Sammy Whitney? You'll have to unmute your microphone.
Gone off to make a cup of tea.
Yeah.
Probably. Julie Pearson. Sammy, Julie, do either of you have any questions for our panelists this evening?
Oh, hello there. Hi. I popped in because I was really interested, and I've come across a few of you before. I've listened with great interest about honesty, and I work in teacher training in higher education, and I think honesty really is one of the pinpoint things to do. But bearing in mind, as you've just discussed, how teachers, we just take on so much, and the more we do, the better we look, and you know, nothing will crush us. How I'm trying really hard to do that in HE is to be honest and say, you don't have to take that on board. And I don't know what your view is. I say there's no such thing as perfect or the top, because there'll always be somebody else who wants to be more perfect and be above you. So how do you manage that between you all? Because I just want to know, because you're the ones with some great ideas.
Oh, I'd love to say I've got all that completely sussed and I have all the answers. I mean, I'll come back to what I said right at the beginning, which is you never clear your desk as an educator, whether you're a teacher in a school or in a university. And I think it's important that people realise that you can work as hard as you like. You could work for 24 hours a day and there would still be more that you could do. Having said that, there are some tools that can help you be more effective in the time that you do spend on the job. And this comes back to something that Adrian was saying earlier. You know, it's awful. It's really stressful turning up on a Monday morning and you haven't organised yourself. So actually, you do need to think about the time that is available and make the most of it. And, you know, be good at making lists and things like that. But definitely, we're not perfect and good enough. I think, you know, Catherine coined it really well. Good enough is good enough. And the moments of brilliance and being outstanding will come, but quite often not when you've planned all night. Sometimes it comes completely out of the blue.
When I'm working with student teachers, I use the phrase of one more. So rather than wanting to be 10 out of 10, just acknowledge and accept where you are on the scale of 1 to 10. And rather than trying to be 10 out of 10, just try to be one more from where you are. So even if you're 6 out of 10, how can you be 7? So it's a tangible thing that you can manage. And then you can think, well, what are my one mores? Is that simply just to connect with someone? Is that ample? Do I need to go for a run? That's not my one. Do I need a cup of coffee? What do I need to get myself one more? And then when we get ourselves to that new place, then one more on from that seems more tangible and more easily done than the two jump. So I think we need to stop ourselves from being perfectionists, as Catherine said, stop judging ourselves a 10 out of 10 and just acknowledge where we are and try to get ourselves to be one more.
And something I also encourage mentors that I work with in schools is to move away from the notion of feedback after lessons and have a professional learning conversation, because I think feedback is really detrimental. And I've sat in thousands, and if you work in HE, Julie, you will have done the same.
Yeah.
You've sat and listened to a mentor say, how do you think it went? And then get some really bland mush from the trainee. And then they go, well, I thought this was good and this you need to improve on and these are your targets. Meanwhile, the trainee's only hooks on the bad things that are now massive and the whole lesson was a disaster. They've got their targets, but do you know what? They don't own any of that. They've just been gifted it. And actually, I've tried to work with mentors that they don't tell them anything. They just use really clever questioning around the lesson. So the trainee themselves picks out the good, the bad and the ugly bits. And then through clever questioning gets to the relevant targets. And by I say, I mean relevant, because sometimes they could come up with 10, but it's about getting the two maybe that they could work on the most important. So I think sometimes it is around that as well, because you can feel a little bit pummeled as a trainee through your lesson observations and this blur of feedback. So a big shift to sort of learning conversations is I think nicer for everybody.
Mm. I like the terminology, and I think that's the way we've turned. We ask them to focus on one or two targets that we will have that conversation about, rather than that's all very, it's almost like opening a door, isn't it? You open the door, let them in, and you kind of smack it in the face and say, aha, let me tell you. But actually, I think it's great. Professional. It's good. Yeah, thanks. I like that.
That questioning approach is what we're trying to encourage, actually, in the right-hand column of the core content framework. There's a lot of emphasis on those professional conversations and joint deconstruction, not just of the trainees teaching, but actually of things that they might be jointly observing. It might be the mentors teaching, actually, but doing it jointly as a sort of professional dialogue rather than, as you say, that blurt of feedback that so resonated for me when you said that.
It's horrible. But also, I think we need to acknowledge and be open. And I think it is all about open and honesty. It doesn't make us lose our professional credibility by saying that I learn things from trainees. I've seen lessons, well, that's fabulous. And I still use some of the ideas now that I churn around and talk about. So I think we need to be open and stop worrying that us saying that we have bad days diminishes our professional credibility at all.
Mm. I would just add as well that, you know, whether we're a trainee teacher or whatever journey we're on, is to get into the habit of, you know, at the end of the teaching day or the end of the day before you go to bed, is just write down a couple of things that, you know, small wins, small successes, because particularly as a trainee, you will be obsessed with the things that aren't going right, that one lesson that completely bombed, the one child that kicked off or whatever. And I remember distinctly from my very first year in teaching, you know, when some lessons, literally as I'm teaching them, I'm thinking, oh my God, this is a disaster. I would often just look down. There was a girl in my class who was a refugee, had come from a war-torn country, didn't speak English, and she would often just be sitting, looking at me, smiling. And I, you know, the one good thing every day I used to take from it was, you know, at least you are safe in my classroom, even if my lesson on equivalent fractions is completely tanked. You are safe, whereas if you were back in the country you'd come from, you know, your life was completely upside down. So that kept me going. And I think we need to get into the habit of that. The small things that we can be grateful for, the small things, little successes that normally pass us by, let's make more of them and build from them.
I agree.
I think that's really good advice, Adrian. You know, I think for anybody that is passionate about what they do, they are hypercritical of themselves. And I think, again, it comes back to that. Just accept that you shouldn't be aiming for perfect. You should be aiming for good, you know, or good enough. I like your way of doing it mathematically, David, saying, what's your plus one? How do you just take that next step forward? Adrian, and then reflecting on the disaster, you know, that of what was it? What fractions? Scary. Sounds scary, but yeah, that and you know, if that bomb, but what else went well today? You know, what went well today? And I think that's an important practice to have in every work context. It's not just particular to teachers. In every employment context, one should take that ownership of your own well-being and say, listen, I need to make myself well. For example, I need to take the dog for a walk in the morning. I need to do that for my mental health, especially at the moment, especially tomorrow morning, when you know, we're all under lock and key again. I need to take the dog for a walk. Why? Because when I come back, I feel positive and I feel energized. A very good colleague of mine, Kevin Guthrie, who's a counselor here in Newark, he speaks about what's your oxygen, what gives you fire, what gives you flame, right? And I think that's quite important, is to be kind to yourself. You know, that's the most difficult. It's easy to be kind to somebody else. You're thinking about it. It's practical. You're being kind to them, but you're much more critical and harmful to yourself. And at this time, particularly, be kind to yourself. I know we're out of time, folks, and I'd like to give you all one more round to put in some words. We have recorded this. We want to make it available for teachers to view, to download, to share. Sam, can we start with you?
What a pearl of wisdom. Is that what you're looking for? Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to piggyback on what Adrian just said. I thought that refugee example was absolutely brilliant. I know a lot, nearly all the research that looks at why teachers choose to be teachers in the first place, what brings them into the profession, is because they want to make a difference. It might be because they want to make a difference because they're passionate about the subject, or it might be because they're passionate about five-year-olds and their learning, but they want to make a difference to individuals and to society. And there's so many ways that you make a difference. It's not just about whether you've taught equivalent fractions effectively that day. You will be making a difference to children in your class in a whole range of different ways, and just catching them and smiling at them and making them feel safe and reassured is just as important as whether they've got equivalent fractions. So I think, you know, keep your well-being in tune with why you came into the profession by reminding yourself of that, and then looking for examples of how you're achieving that.
Good advice. Catherine?
I would say, on a positive note, of course, stop with the perfectionist endeavor, but also just enjoy your time in the classroom. You know, it's a joyous time. What a privilege it is, and don't forget the privilege that we have to work with the children that we do and enjoy what we do. There are going to be bumps in the road, of course there are, but step back, reflect. Sometimes you can learn then a few years down the line, sometimes a week down the line, to laugh at them, but enjoy what you're doing, because it is a joyful job in many ways. So just enjoy it.
Adrian?
I would link to Sam's point, actually, about always remind yourself about why you got into the classroom in the first place, because that having that core sense of purpose, that allows you to answer more easily that question, like, what really matters? And when you can answer that question, what really matters, you will find it easier to exercise your agency and let go of the stuff you know doesn't matter, and do the stuff and spend your precious time on the stuff that does matter. And a question that I now share with teachers on teacher training, and I reflect on myself, is, if this was going to be my last year in teaching, what would I do differently? What would I keep doing? Because I know it's important, it matters, but what would I do differently? Because it's a question I asked myself quite early on in my career when I was thinking about leaving. And that allowed me to get, again, back to that reason. Why am I here? What really matters? And I had the courage — that word has come up quite a bit today — I had the courage then to be experimental, take bolder kind of actions. And you know what? At the end of that year, I found the joy in teaching, like Catherine said, and that's kept me in the classroom.
Phenomenal. David?
Well, it's always difficult to go last, isn't it? I guess keep connecting. There's always someone there. If you need a cheerleader, go and find a cheerleader who's going to celebrate you are for whoever you are and whatever you are. If you need some creative challenge, go to the creative person and get that challenge. So connect. I think we've all discovered during COVID that we all, as human beings, we're not only vulnerable, we're not only imperfect, but we're also connectable. And so we need to find the right people at the right time, and surround ourselves with these people, nurture those relationships, so then when we need them most, they are always there in teaching, but in the wider world as well.
Thank you all very much. This has been a highly insightful panel. I think we should have made it 2 or maybe 3 hours, but I'm conscious that, you know, you've all worked long days. I really do appreciate you joining this panel discussion tonight. I really hope that we can reach out to more young teachers, particularly people that are considering themselves as perfectionists. I hope they've heard tonight, Catherine, what you've had to say. Sam, I hope people have understood what the ITT framework is about. It's not a Bible, so to speak. It is just a framework. It is there as a guideline, and you need to fill in the dots, join the dots. Adrian, highly insightful. Practical example, practical experience. Thank you all very much for this evening, and stay safe, stay sane, as sane as possible. Please consider your mental health and well-being as well, especially during lockdown. It can't be easy. Do what you need to do to appreciate yourself and those around you, of course, your colleagues and your loved ones. Thank you very much, and good evening, everyone.